Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Across the UK, online, on DAB, and on your smart speaker. The Independent Republic of Mike Graham on Talk Radio.
Good morning and welcome to the Independent Republic of Mike Graham on Talk Radio. It's a bit of a turn up for the books, isn't it? It was the return of Prime Minister's questions today, and the big question had been, will the Prime Minister actually return? Turns out he's got a pretty good excuse for not turning up because he's just become a new father. A spokesman for the Prime Minister and his partner said both mother and baby are doing very well after the birth in a London hospital on Wednesday morning. The spokeswoman said the Prime Minister and Ms Simmons are thrilled to announce the birth of a healthy baby boy at a London hospital earlier this morning. Both mother and baby are doing very well. The PM and Ms Simmons would like to thank the fantastic NHS maternity team. Well, funnily enough, we were going to talk about Boris Johnson this morning anyway, because he did return to work on Monday. He did make a statement outside of Downing Street. He wasn't going to be doing Prime Minister's questions today, clearly because of the news that the baby might have been coming at any moment and he might have to run out of the chamber on the basis that he got the call. Where we have all been, or some of us have anyway. I certainly have been there four times. But what a delightful thing for him to have to be able to celebrate today. We can send our congratulations from Talk Radio. Congratulations to Boris. Congratulations to the NHS. Congratulations to carry as well, and it's just a fantastic time. However, we've got lots of other things to talk about as well. Rachel Sylvester joins us from The Times. She wrote a very interesting piece yesterday about Boris the man, Boris the leader, Boris the politician, Boris the guy who almost died from coronavirus, and how that's affecting the way that he now leads the country. This is another turn up for the books, and I'm sure Rachel will be able to take that on board as well. We'll talk to her very shortly. 0344 499 1000. We also will be asking when the return of the lockdown conversation is going to happen, because clearly the government has now slightly moved the goalposts and made it slightly easier for them to pass the five rules of the coronavirus lockdown being lifted. We'll come into that later on. We'll talk about British Airways as well. We'll be talking to Ben Habib later on about what we should be reopening. Should we be opening hotels, restaurants, fast food joints, schools, all of the above? We shall see. And coming up on homeschooling today, we're going to be learning all about chocolate, believe it or not. Plus, we're going to be joined by Tapau star Carol Decker, who's got a new single coming out. You heard it here first. You're listening to me, Mike Graham, on the fastest growing radio station on the planet. It is, of course, Talk Radio.
Mid-morning with Mike Graham. Talk Radio.
Let's say a very good morning to Times political columnist Rachel Sylvester. What a time to be coming on the radio, Rachel.
Goodness, yeah, what a rollercoaster ride for Boris Johnson. So he's gone from the intensive care unit, and then today a new healthy baby boy born, we're hearing. And everyone was speculating about whether he was going to be well enough to do Prime Minister's questions. And, of course, now he's not going to. He's going to spend time with his new family.
Yes, well,
what an extraordinary thing.
I know. What an incredible year he's had. I mean, it really is quite remarkable. I feel very happy for him. I think that's a natural thing. I mean, I'm a father. I don't know whether you're a mother, but, you know, it's always a happy event. And, you know, no doubt there will be...
Yeah, it's not a time to be churlish, is it?
It really isn't. I'm sure there will be some people out there who perhaps hang around in places like The Guardian that will have things to say, which might be a bit churlish, but we're not going to go there. You wrote a great piece yesterday about Boris the man, and how you kind of perceive him to have changed slightly since his experience in the intensive care unit.
Yeah, I think what's really fascinating is whether this will be the moment when he can go from a sort of populist rabble-riser into a genuine statesman. And he is now trying to, he's talking about the importance of unifying the country, trying to build consensus around the nations and between parties.
Yeah.
So he was quite a divisive figure. And I talked to one cabinet minister at the weekend who said to me they thought he changed having been through, you know, to hell and back, really, with coronavirus, and that he'd become more serious and also developed this emotional connection to the NHS,
right,
which actually now presumably will be even stronger.
Well, it's very interesting, isn't it? In the official statement, they're already thanking the fantastic NHS maternity team, in their words. So there's clearly a massive bond now between the Boris Johnson that we now know, Carrie Simmons, and the NHS.
Well, and I think that was always a sort of political positioning bond, if you like. So Boris Johnson knew that the NHS is incredibly popular. It's the closest thing the British people have to a religion, as someone once said. And everyone loves the NHS. Everyone experiences it, whether it's through the birth of a child or the death of someone they love or just going to the doctor with an illness. But this has given him a very personal connection, I think. And that's, that does... If you've been right at the very edge of life and the doctors and nurses have saved your life, then I think that really does change the way you feel about it as well as the way you see it. It's not just a, you know, political branding question now. It's a real psychological bond.
Yes, and I think because there are still quite a lot of people in this country who are not really taking this whole dreadful situation as seriously perhaps as they might do. You know, those who say it's time to lift the lockdown, you know, we can't have a situation where the economy is damaged and the damage from that is worse than the actual virus itself. Because he will be sitting there saying, well, hang on, I know exactly how bad this disease is. And so it's bound to have an effect on his decision making.
Yeah, and he's always been the great gambler at Westminster. He's one of the sort of, in a way, reckless or at least risk-taking politicians. Both, you know, and now I think, I just wonder whether he'll have developed and realised the importance of caution and that sometimes you can't take risks with people's lives. And when you've been right to the brink, it makes you sort of question those risk-taking decisions maybe a little bit. And I think certainly the ministers I've been talking to who've spoken to Boris Johnson say he's more nervous now about rushing to unlock everything. And I think to begin with, remember, he made all those jokes about coronavirus. He was going to call the ventilator search Operation Last Gasp and things like that. And it was all, he's going around boasting that he'd shaken everybody's hand at the hospital and we'll send this coronavirus packing. But the tone of his statements since he's come out of hospital, I don't know if you agree, but there's been a sort of more serious tone and a more, you know, sort of looking straight down the camera, recognising the gravity of this situation and that it's on his shoulders as a leader. In the end, this isn't something there's no right answer to this. It's not something that the cabinet is definitely going to agree on. Some people lean one way, some people lean the other way. And in the end, it's the responsibility of the prime minister's to decide how to make these incredibly difficult judgment calls.
Yes, of course. And I mean, as far as the way that will happen is concerned, I mean, you also made the point that Dominic Raab was a kind of, you know, very un-Boris-like replacement. So in a way, that was better for Boris because when he comes back, you sort of see the contrast. I actually thought that Dominic Raab wasn't doing a bad job.
He was sort of quiet and got on with it, wasn't he? But he didn't try and step up to be prime ministerial in any way, shape or form.
No.
And remember, he had ambitions to be leader only a few months ago and he was talked of as a potential successor to Theresa May. But that he didn't come across like that at all, did he, when he did step in? He didn't sort of be flaunting his ambition in any way. And it is quite interesting how a crisis like this reveals the strength and the true character of politicians. So someone like, I think, Rishi Sunak has come across as a really credible, quite a serious figure in a way that he hadn't had the chance to show before.
I think Matt Hancock's done rather well too, don't you?
I do. He's been criticised by quite a lot of people, but I think he's had a sort of energy and determination. He's gripped the thing as soon as it was decided this was serious. You know, he managed to get all those hospitals built in, I think the first one was in 9 days or something.
Yeah, that's right.
And we were all sitting aghast when China managed to build a hospital so quickly. But actually, they did it, the NHS did it here. And that was partly because I think Hancock banged heads together and said, right, we've just got to get on with this. I think you can criticise the government perhaps for not taking it seriously enough right at the beginning of the year and perhaps dragging their feet a little bit, hoping it wasn't going to be as bad as it has ended up being.
Yes, I mean, I think I imagine listening to some voices in the Tory party, that might have also been due to the fact that, that there was a lot of resistance to any kind of economic shutdown, because already now we're hearing from certain people in the 1922 committee, for a start, saying that, you know, it's time we lifted this economic lockdown, because otherwise the damage will be worse. So there's always been, I think, that issue within the cabinet, hasn't there?
Yes, exactly. And but then actually, all the things the government has done have been incredibly unconservative. So these billions of pounds worth of bailouts, effectively nationalising, you know, millions of workers, paying salaries for those on furlough, 80% of salaries. That's the other thing I think is quite interesting about whether Boris Johnson has changed in his politics because of his experience. Because when he was a columnist, it was all, you know, health and safety gone mad and anti the nanny state. Now he's praising the NHS as the beating heart of Britain, and he's pouring squillions into not just health but into economic support in a way that I don't think he would have believed in the past as sort of traditional Tory leader.
No, and certainly his libertarian sort of nuances seem to have been all kind of planed off the sides of him, don't they?
Yeah, exactly. Although I thought there was one really interesting thing when he came out of hospital and he praised the nurses. It was Luis from Portugal and Jenny from New Zealand who'd looked after him. And he made a point of making clear and saying that they were from other countries.
Yeah.
And he's always been instinctively quite liberal on immigration. But the government that he's led since he got in, and the immigration rules that they published last month, I think, or the month before, were quite tough. So I just wonder whether there'll be a change on that. For example, care workers were excluded from the NHS visa. And that now seems a bit foolish.
Yes, I mean, the whole care worker and the care home sector has been a problem. And I've been talking about this for quite a few months, even before all this happened, that, you know, we've been sort of leading up to a massive problem with care homes and the way that they've been run over the past few years anyway, because the idea that somehow you save up all of your money, all of your life, and you have a house that you can pass on to your children, but then you have to give it back to the government to pay for your care seems bonkers to me. And the whole sector, I think, needs an overhaul.
Yeah, and what's particularly unfair is if you get dementia or Alzheimer's and you have to go into a home, you could be there for 10, 20 years. You can spend hundreds and thousands and millions of pounds on your care, whereas somebody else who gets cancer, for example, has all that treatment paid for by the NHS.
Yes.
So there's a real unfairness in the system. And if anything comes out of this, I really hope that the government finally grips that and deals with that unfairness. And it does mean us all paying a bit more, I think, probably, for social care, so that nobody ends up having to pay everything.
Yes, and I think people would accept that, absolutely. One final thought, Rachel. I mean, Boris, he's got enough on his plate. He's now going to be having the old sleepless nights, which I can remember very well from quite a few years ago. But you somehow managed to kind of wander through it zombie-like. But, you know, it's not going to be easy to be Prime Minister when the baby's waking you up at 4 a.m.
No, and also, he can't be fully fit. You know, if you've been that sick, it must take several weeks or even months to recover fully.
I mean, I thought he looked very well on Monday when we saw
him. Well, I agree, but I just, you know, he's going to be getting tired, isn't he, anyway?
Yeah. Oh, I would have thought He's not much younger than me, so I mean, you know, he's really going to be sort of burning the candle at not just both ends, but every end and the middle as well.
Yeah, exactly. But there is one, he has got a sort of energy and an optimism, and also an ability to away with words that makes him, in a way, uniquely well suited to this role now, because the country, it does need cheering up, it does need bringing together, but it also needs somebody who can explain why these difficult decisions are being made, and also not just offer everyone the easy answers. There are some difficult things that are going to need to be done. We're not going to be able to go back to normal straight away, and he does have potentially the talent to do that if he, you know, has the bravery to rise above the day to day.
Yes, absolutely right. Rachel, thank you so much for talking to us. Rachel Sylvester, political columnist at The Times, with her take on Boris Johnson and how he has changed as a man and as a leader since the hospitalisation that he had to have for coronavirus and the ICU unit that he was in for 3 days, where at one point he said it was 50-50 whether he actually survived it or not. Today we learn that he's a new father. And of course, he's already got four other children. He's got the fifth one now with Carrie Simmons. And of course, that will mean that they're a very happy couple, but they will be very tired. Let's talk to Charlotte Ivers, our political correspondent, to find out precisely what will happen next. Charlotte, very good morning to you.
Good morning, Mike.
Yeah, I mean, let the bells ring out, I suppose, is the message. There's a few lefties making some ridiculous comments on social media. We'll get to them later. Some people are asking me, will Boris Johnson take 2 weeks paternity leave? I suspect he probably won't.
Well, he did say that he was going to. Gosh, it must be a few months now when this had first been announced, or not even that long, to be honest. But yes, I imagine probably not at this time, although he won't be doing Prime Minister's question time at midday today. Perhaps unsurprisingly, Dominic Raab is going to be taking that one for him.
Yes, and it looks now as though Carrie Simmons conceived the baby sort of more like July and managed to keep a sort of pretty good secret of it all. I mean, it's not that unusual for people in the public eye to do this, to say that they're pregnant, but the birth date is sort of further in the future than it actually is.
No, that's very true. And there has been a rumour of this pregnancy in Westminster for a very, very long time. It almost sort of became a running joke that a different journalist every day would decide that they definitely knew that this was happening. But clearly the couple decided that they wanted to keep it private for as long as possible coming up to the due date.
Yes, I think that's absolutely right. But I mean, this probably took most people, even including you guys in the lobby, by surprise today, didn't it?
Absolutely. Well, over the weekend and indeed over the last couple of days, we'd all been asking, is the Prime Minister going to do Prime Minister's question time? And basically didn't get an answer. And up until about 2 hours ago, people from the Labour Party were saying to me, we still don't know whether Keir Starmer will be facing Boris Johnson or Dominic Raab. And that was very odd. And retrospectively, of course, this makes a huge amount of sense, but I don't think anyone saw it coming.
No, quite. And I mean, is it possible that he could take time off? Because, I mean, surely this is the moment at which the government really has to get to grips with the lockdown decision. And they've already said that next week possibly is going to be a key week in terms of making some kind of easing of the lockdown. So I can't imagine that he could really take time off, could he?
No, I think that would be very, very difficult for him, potentially a couple of days. But certainly when he came back to work on Monday, all that you were hearing from those around him, from other people in the cabinet, even from backbench MPs, was that he brought a new energy back in and that everyone suddenly felt like there was a direction again. So I think to walk away again 2 days later, he'd have a lot of angry mutterings from his own side, probably not in public because they'd look very ungenerous, of course, but I think behind closed doors, and we know the Parliamentary Conservative Party loves nothing more than muttering behind closed doors about one of their colleagues, there would be a lot of discontent.
Yes. I mean, we're told that they're both thrilled, both very happy. The baby's very healthy. So there's great news there for everybody. Lots of congratulations coming in from various other members of the cabinet, Rishi Sunak, Matt Hancock. They're all saying well done to Boris and many congratulations to the couple. What has he been doing since he got back on Monday? Because, you know, obviously he hasn't shared any of the media briefings. We're wondering whether he might do one of those soon. I guess we probably won't see that this week. But what's your understanding of what he's been doing inside of Downing Street?
Well, so essentially what he was doing before he went into hospital, which is taking advice that had been presented to him from various different directions. The key meeting he will have had some advice on is the meeting of SAGE, the Scientific Advisory Group, yesterday.
Yeah.
They actually went through various different options for easing the lockdown and will now have options to present to the Prime Minister so he can pick which one he thinks is most palatable, it has the best trade-offs within it. So that will be really interesting. The sooner those get in front of the Prime Minister, the sooner we will start to see, if not an actual easing of the lockdown, certainly ministers actually starting to talk to us about what the easing of the lockdown might look like.
Yes, because the key change in one of the rules for the lockdown being softened, which is in the front page of the Telegraph today, is quite an interesting one, isn't it? So that basically not having a risk that would engulf or overwhelm the NHS rather than having a risk of any kind. Because in a way, when I saw that the first time, I thought, well, the risk of a second peak is pretty difficult to wipe out altogether. So they've now kind of watered that down a bit, haven't they?
No, absolutely. And it's a bit of an odd one because, as you say, there is that linguistic change, which I think they were sort of hoping to sneak past us without us noticing that it was there. But I think really, to be honest, overall, they've always known that risk of a second peak is there. Always the strategy has been to avoid the NHS being overwhelmed. And under those terms, the government has been incredibly successful on the task they set themselves of not overwhelming the NHS. They have been very successful. It's the other things like the PPE, like the economy, like everything that comes around the side, like the death rates in care homes, that there is a bit more of a debate about. But they'll be very happy with the results on the actual NHS capacity front.
Absolutely right. Well, Charlotte, we'll be joining you later on for Prime Minister's Questions, presumably in the company of Dominic Raab and Keir Starmer. So we'll see you at midday. Charlotte Ivers there, our political correspondent, checking in with us on the news that Boris Johnson and Carrie Simmons have had a baby boy, a healthy baby boy, born at a London hospital. They're thanking the NHS. They're thanking the maternity staff. Everybody's very happy about it, apart from one or two lefties who seem to be content to put out very strange messages. It's all very odd. But this is Talk Radio. We are live streaming on YouTube, on Facebook and on Twitter, of course. We'll be talking about Boris Johnson's baby, maybe some names for the baby boy as well. It's all coming up on Talk Radio.
Mid-morning with Mike Graham. Talk Radio. The Independent Republic of Mike Graham on Talk Radio.
Welcome back to the Independent Republic of Mike Graham right here on Talk Radio. Now, just for a little surprise, we thought, why not get Carol Decker on the phone? Because while all this coronavirus talk is going on and this pandemic talk is going on, and now we've got Boris Johnson's baby, we've got lots of news to talk about, we've got testing to be done. How about let's talk about the pop music business and Carol Decker from Tapao and a new single. Carol, very good morning to you.
Morning, Michael.
How are you?
I've actually got pink eyes.
Have you?
Yeah.
Have you been looking through the keyhole?
Yeah, I have been spying on my neighbours. Something to do. No, you know all the pollen that was flying around last week with that gorgeous weather. Well, my eyes just turned into red hot coals.
And oh God!
Antibiotic drops.
Oh well, well. Hopefully, you can get those because I mean, some people have said it's not that easy to find stuff like that because of everybody sort of bulk buying everything. But hopefully, you'll be able to get them.
It has to be given to you by the chemist. So I got in the queue. And sort of tried to show the pharmacist my eye from 2 metres away.
Right.
And then he picked some drops off the shelf and threw them at me.
Right. Well, listen, this is what we have to think about doing now. Let's talk, though, because we've got a great deal of time. Now, bizarrely, we can't play this for you, only because of the rules on YouTube. They won't let us play the music. So even though you could give us permission to play it, we can't play it. But I've watched the video that you've made, which is fantastic. It's of you of dancing around your lovely garden, surrounded by all manner of animals, including Finn, your dog, who looks spectacular. Tell us about how you did it.
Okay, well, new single, everybody, called Be Wonderful, and it's on pre-order, all the downloads on the 1st, and then it gets released on the 8th of May on all the usual platforms. It's called Be Wonderful. So we had to do a lockdown video. We managed to record and master the song before all this kicked off, and we wanted a video. And so, conveniently, both of my children, Scarlett, who's 21, and Dylan, who's 17, they've done a BTEC in creative media production. So they know how to storyboard, film, edit, and we've got all the software and the cameras, and so I put them to work, family business.
Very good.
And we used household props, we used the chickens, we used the duck, we used the dog. We used a lot of we went for a funny angle, which I hope
I did. No, I thought it was great. Yeah. But also, it was just a kind of, I mean, at the moment, almost anything is a happy and very welcome change from what we're watching on TV. So, you know, it's very nice to be able to watch something. What I was hoping you could do is maybe put something out on Twitter, which I can then retweet, then people can actually see it and hear it a little bit.
We're doing a snippet today. We're doing an edit of the video today because we had some minor adjustments to do. And then we'll put a snippet up on YouTube Friday. The downloads will go up and there'll be a snippet up there.
Yes.
And then the full thing will be out on YouTube very shortly. So, and of course, you know, if you go on my Twitter, which is just @CarolDecker, I'm always blathering on about where things are, so you can find it.
And also, of course, people will think, my goodness me, that song China in My Hand 23 years ago, a long time ago. But you've not stopped working, really, have you?
I hate to tell you, it was probably 30 years ago. 1987. No, I haven't. I'm always working. It's frustrating. All my shows have been cancelled this year, like a lot of entertainers. Every single one has been taken out of the diary. Most of them are planning to reschedule for next year. Keep fingers crossed, but sometimes things just, it just doesn't happen again, you know, but most of them hopefully will be. We'll see each other on the other side of this. And I think the gigs are going to be so poignant when everybody gets back on the road, you know?
Well, I can imagine there'll be a sort of scene like Glastonbury with everybody standing 2 metres apart from one another. They'll have to kind of increase the size of the field by a factor of 10. And you'll just have to have a lot more speakers.
I know. The queues for the toilets will be even longer. All the festivals will be funny. Yeah, no, but I can't wait to just get back to normal. I know we're all doing the right thing and we can only go on what we're told, but I do feel a bit like I'm pacing up and down a bit. I just want the world to come back to us.
I think we all kind of last weekend realised for the first time it's time for us to try and find a way out of this, you know?
Yeah, because we've had to be guided by the science and stuff, but we've got to have something to come back to. And some people say, oh, are you picking money over people's health? You're not.
No.
You know, we are the economy.
Yeah.
We are the politics, the people.
And we're the country as well.
Yeah, and we have to have something to come back to, and we're going to have to take a calculated risk.
Now, I've got a text message here from somebody who doesn't give a name. Is it true, is the question, that China in Your Hand is about Frankenstein?
It is about Mary Shelley writing the book.
Is it?
Frankenstein. Yeah, it's a story within a story.
Okay.
That's why the opening lines are, it was a theme she had on a scheme he had. So it's about her, because she was 19 when she wrote the book.
Yeah.
And it caused a lot of jealousies in her circle. You know, she was married to Lord Shelley and they hung out with Byron. There was a whole kind of intellectual clique that lived around the sort of Fitzrovia area. And she basically had this massive Pulp Fiction hit.
Right.
At the age of 19. So I was watching a documentary about it and I found that angle on it really interesting. And then I think, did Byron die? There was all sorts of things happened and it sort of, they thought of it as a curse on the group. And so it was a kind of be careful what you wish for parable, which also is the story of Frankenstein, isn't it?
Yeah. It is. It's fascinating. Yeah. It's a wonderful book to read, actually. So I didn't know that. Yeah. So now I've learned something. So that's brilliant. Carol, thank you very much indeed. We'll look out for the video clip and we'll get it going around later on today.
And the single's called Be Wonderful. Thanks, Mike.
No problem at all, Carol. Take care. Carol Decker, Pink Eye, and of course, looking forward to the release of a new single called Be Wonderful. It's going to be out on May the 8th, pre-orders from May the 1st. Look out on my Twitter and on her Twitter later on for a version of the video, which is very, very funny, I have to say.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Mid-morning with Mike Graham. Talk Radio. The Independent Republic of Mike Graham on Talk Radio.
Welcome back to the Independent Republic of Mike Graham, and welcome back to homeschooling. So if you haven't done it yet, go and get your children, grab them and bring them gently towards the radio, have them sit around, because we've been learning about a great many things this week. We had changing of the guard yesterday. We learned a little bit about Stonehenge the day before that. Today we're going to learn about chocolate with Jennifer Earle. And Jennifer Earle is the founder of Chocolate Ecstasy Tours, which sounds like rather a good job to me. Jennifer, very good afternoon to you. Welcome.
Afternoon.
Thanks very much indeed for joining us. So, tell us about, first of all, Chocolate Ecstasy Tours and what you do.
We have fabulous guided tours in London, and we visit chocolate shops and ice cream parlours.
Wow. But I presume that's not so easy to do right now, though, is it?
No, we are on hold at the moment.
Yeah. You can just eat the chocolate at the moment. I seem to have acquired an awful lot of chocolate lately because we have a little trolley that comes in here, and I take a bar of chocolate home with me every night. And I've realised I don't eat a bar of chocolate every night, so I've now started to collect about 10 or 15 bars of chocolate in a tin, which I'll probably scoff at some point or other. But I'm a big fan of chocolate, always have been. What's your favourite chocolate?
Oh, it totally depends on my mood. I'm a big fan of dark chocolate.
Are you? Yes.
Italy. No, yeah. I like it all.
Okay. Let's start with the first question, I suppose. Where does chocolate come from?
So chocolate starts life as a fruit on a tree.
Okay. A cocoa tree.
And so you find cocoa trees near the equator in countries that are really hot.
Yes.
And the process of turning the fruit from the cocoa tree, it's actually the seeds of the fruit, into chocolate is takes quite a few weeks.
Okay. And is that done there, or is it sort of shipped somewhere where it's done elsewhere?
So it used to be that the chocolate was always made in the countries where it's predominantly eaten, so yeah. In Europe and the US and
right.
other.
Because I've always found it interesting that different types of countries have different types of chocolate. You know, like American chocolate, for me, was never quite as good as British chocolate, which was never quite as good as Swiss chocolate, you know, which was never quite as good as German chocolate. And it's all slightly different, isn't it?
Yeah, so there's a few reasons that it's different. The main reason that the difference between the different countries is actually because of the milk. So
okay.
It's not as obvious when you try dark chocolates from those countries. So
right.
In the US, they sour their milk before it's mixed in, which was an accident to begin with.
Really?
Because the people who bought it liked that they kept it up. That's
right.
At least. And then just the same as you have different tasting cheeses, is all about the milk. So what the cows are eating affects the taste of the
okay.
milk, affects the cheese. It also affects the milk chocolate.
Interesting. So can you kind of do chocolate tastings, if you like?
Yes. Definitely. So the biggest thing that makes a difference between what chocolate tastes like is actually the beans. And so that's the main part of any chocolate, the cocoa beans that come from the fruit
right.
of the tree. And so that, there's lots of different factors that affect that. So you have different varieties of cocoa fruits. There's different ways that they can be fermented, and different ways they can be dried, different ways they can be roasted, and all of those things can change. And it's incredible how if you have a bar of chocolate that only has cocoa beans and sugar, which a good dark chocolate should, if they've come from different makers or the beans have come from different places, they can taste incredibly different.
Mm. And when they make chocolate bars, say, for example, which we eat an awful lot of in this country, is that considered to be a bit kind of naff, if you like? If you're a chocolate sort of, you know, aficionado, would you say something like a Snickers is a little bit kind of down market?
I think if you enjoy it and it's making you feel happy in the moment and it's not too frequent, then it's fine. However, it doesn't have a lot of actual cocoa in it. So if you were to look at the ingredients,
right.
it wouldn't really satisfy a chocolate craving. It would satisfy a sugar craving,
yes.
but not so
and of course, one of the things that I found fascinating about chocolate, and particularly in Mexico, is where they use it in cooking, and they use it in kind of savoury dishes, and they'll put it, say, in chili. And I've been to, there's a restaurant here in London in Borough Market, which you probably know, Rabot, which does a chocolate kind of menu, chocolate-based menu, but it's regular food. I had, I think I had some lamb there, and it was served with a sort of a chocolate relish, which was quite remarkable.
Yeah, I've been a few times. Interesting is cocoa actually doesn't have any sugar in it. So although chocolate always has sugar in it, you can buy bars of chocolate that have zero sugar in it.
Right.
It looks like chocolate and smells like chocolate, but they don't quite taste like it. And they're technically not allowed to be called chocolate.
Uh-huh.
But if you have just that 100%, just the cocoa, it's not sweet. It's just got lots of depth and interesting flavors. There's actually more flavor compounds in cocoa than there is in any other food on the planet.
Right.
So people talk about wine and all the different flavors they can get from that. Or the same with coffee. Chocolate has more than both of them.
And why is it that you can only grow cocoa plants basically in those parts of the world where they currently grow? Because like you just mentioned wine, you know, wine is now produced in many, many countries, but cocoa apparently isn't.
No, so you can grow cocoa in Europe if it's within a greenhouse, but unfortunately it will die if it's exposed to cold. The plant won't survive,
okay.
So it won't bear fruit.
But you'd think that there would be parts of the US, for example, that would be hot enough to grow it in, or parts of, Spain?
The bits of the US that would be potentially hot enough wouldn't have enough rain, most likely. So you can actually grow it. It grows in Hawaii. And it grows in, which is part of the year, and it grows in the north of Australia where they do have both rain.
Oh, okay. And is it, does that taste significantly different or not really?
It tastes a little different, but not. It's still very under-researched in cocoa compared to other fruits. So the jury's still out as to whether the bigger difference is the variety of cocoa beans, like the cocoa seeds that are planted to it. The trees are, or whether it's the process from harvesting them to turning into chocolate bar that makes a bigger difference.
Okay. And what about the feeling that you get when you eat chocolate? Because we're always told that it makes you feel good to eat chocolate. So what is that all about?
Again, there's a couple of theories. So it could be connected to the fact that we're often given chocolate as for special occasions when we're young, which we then associate with happy feelings.
Yeah.
However, within cocoa, so as well as it being the most flavour complex food, it actually has a greater number of vitamins and minerals than any other food that's actually on the planet.
Okay.
So it's hitting lots of things our body needs in order to function well, but it also has some psychoactive compounds as well. So things that supposedly will affect our serotonin in our brain, which is what makes us feel happy.
Yes. And, I mean, is it even possible, if you can answer this question, to put a figure on how much chocolate is produced every year around the world?
Excellent question that I don't know off the top of my head, but it is hundreds of millions of kilos at a minimum.
Yeah. And does it go off? I don't tend to keep it for that long because I'm too busy eating it, but does it go off, chocolate?
So milk chocolate will, and white chocolate will, because if there's any milk in it at all of any type, even if it's a non-dairy milk, it will go rancid. But dark chocolate, so just cocoa beans and sugar, will last, as long as it's kept well, will last forever. It might not taste delicious, but it will still be edible.
Okay.
And you could make it taste delicious by retempering it.
All right. And if anybody wants to learn some more, have you got a website people can look at?
I do. So I'm actually just, because as you mentioned, I go into schools and do sessions on chocolate. I've created some worksheets that I thought might be helpful for parents who need a few more activities. And so it's some self-study and a guide to family tasting session and a quiz as well. So
that's good.
Yeah, you can find that on my website, which is chocolateecstasytours.com. There's a link on the homepage.
Brilliant. Okay. Fantastic. Well, Jennifer, thank you very much indeed. It was very educational. Jennifer Earle, founder of the Chocolate Ecstasy Tours. Go to her website and you can find some stuff to do there. And I'm sure you won't have any trouble convincing the children to get involved with some chocolate. Maybe you could cook something with chocolate. You could melt some chocolate, put it on a cake. You never know. You make some chocolate biscuits. All manner of things could be done. That was the homeschooling for today. We'll have more coming up tomorrow at 12:30. If there's anything you want us to actually do that your children would like to learn something about, by all means, text me 87222. You can tweet me as well, of course, at IROMG or at Talk Radio. Coming up next, we're going to talk to Professor John Newton about the new national testing program, which hopes to test something like 15 million more Britons. We'll be back after this on Talk Radio.
Mid-morning with Mike Graham. Talk Radio. The Independent Republic of Mike Graham on Talk Radio.
Welcome back to the Independent Republic of Mike Graham. Coming up at 1 o'clock, Ian Collins will be here. I'm delighted to say now that we're going to talk to Professor John Newton, coordinator of the National Testing Programme, also director of the Public Health Improvement for Public Health England. Professor John, a very good afternoon to you. Welcome.
Hello, Mike. Thank you.
Thank you very much indeed for joining us. We're obviously hearing some great news on the testing front. Up to 15 million more Britons can get tested for COVID-19 from today. What do we hope to learn from the increasing number of tests that are going on?
Well, yes, we've made great progress in building the testing capacity the country needs to respond to coronavirus. Mm. And we've been gradually opening that out to wider groups. Started with NHS staff, getting them back to work, obviously treating patients as well, but also the care sector, we opened it out there. Now, of course, we're opening out to people over 65 who've got symptoms and might be at home or their household. So what that does is to help people to decide on what to do in terms of self-isolating. If you've got symptoms now and you test positive, you know you've got to be really careful. Of course, the other group are workers who can't work from home.
Yeah.
And for them, if you test negative, that means you can go back to work. So this is partly about looking after the most vulnerable people, but also about getting people back to work where we can.
Yes. I mean, we've heard an awful lot about how Germany did a lot of testing, a lot of tracing as well in the early stages of this, and that was why their figures were a bit lower than ours. But we're now hearing that they're getting a bit of a second peak coming because they may have lifted the lockdown a bit sooner. Is the testing that they did specifically something that did help them, or was it more about the tracing?
Well, I'm glad you say that, because I don't think it's at all clear that the amount of testing that they did is the reason that they had better outcomes.
No.
Many people I've spoken to, including colleagues in Germany, feel that the coronavirus was just different. There was less coronavirus in Germany, and they did more testing, which is obviously good. So we don't really know. I suspect it's a bit of both.
Yes.
I think the important thing is, as you mentioned now, we've got really big capacity, similar to that in Germany, which puts us in a good place for the future, for when we start to move into the next phase and we can deliver testing to support contact tracing.
Yes, and is this testing that we're talking about now, that which we'll be giving to over 65, is that something that they do themselves, or do they go somewhere to get it done?
Well, it can be both. So if people want to test, if they've got symptoms, they log on, go to gov.uk, and then there's a link for people who are over 65 or if you're a worker, and then you've got a number of options. You can either go to a drive-in centre, and we're opening more of those all the time, or you can have a test delivered to you at home.
And what is it actually? I know this might sound a bit stupid. What's the actual procedure? What do you actually have to do?
Well, the swabbing is has to be done carefully, but it's relatively straightforward. There's a video for people who are testing at home. There's a video to show you exactly what to do. It's a swab in the nose and a swab from the throat, and then you put it back into the tube, break the swab off, and send it off.
Mm, okay. And as far as that's the test to see whether you have it or not, right? So if you test negative,
yeah.
Is your recommendation to continue to test? Is it possible, for example, that you could have a symptom and you could test and then it would say negative?
Well, yes, it's the test for the presence of the virus, the swab test for the presence of the virus. If it's positive, it's very clear you've definitely got the virus. You need to be very careful. If it's negative, it's a good guide that you're okay to go back to work and to behave normally. Of course, still maintaining the social distancing rules that apply to everybody. But it's not an absolute guarantee. And occasionally, we do recommend that people have a repeat test. Or if you are going back to work and you might be in contact with people who are very vulnerable, it's worth bearing in mind and discussing it with your occupational health or your employer.
Yeah.
But it's a good guide to, if you have symptoms, you have a negative test, it's fine to go back to work.
Okay, so there's no lag time as such, because we've heard that in some testing situations you could have a test which only gives you a sort of a point of time in a nutshell. It doesn't give you all of it.
Well, that is true, and no test is perfect, and you can be unlucky. You might have a negative test one day and then become positive the next day. So it's a risk thing. If you have a negative test, it greatly reduces the risk that you have coronavirus, but it doesn't eliminate it completely.
Sure. Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm afraid the press won't be satisfied with that, will they? They'll be giving you a hard time saying, why is it not perfect? You know, this is the thing that I think a lot of us find very frustrating, that people ask questions about the testing as if it's some kind of, absolute, and it can't be, can it?
No, it can't. And in fact, in the laboratory, if the virus is on the swab by the time it gets to the lab, the test is pretty much perfect. But the problem is getting it on the swab and getting the swab to the lab has, you know, it can go wrong. It's a very good test. We're all looking for certainty in the coronavirus, aren't we? And the testing does provide people with quite a lot of reassurance, but still we have to work on the basis of risk.
Sure. And how are you coming along with the antibody test, the one that says whether or not you actually have had it?
Well, this is very exciting. So the things we're doing in the testing program, we're building capacity, making it accessible to people. We're developing new tests. That's the antibody test, and a number of teams are working on that, collaborations between industry and academics and other agencies. There are a number of candidate antibody tests, they're in the testing process at the moment. So we're confident that by the time we need them, we will have good antibody tests.
Okay.
We also want to make them available to people at home, and there are interesting, innovative ways of doing that, which are in test as well.
Yeah. And are they relatively accurate in the sense that they, again, I've been told that there's a sort of 28-day period that they can test for, so that if you've had it in the last 28 days, it will tell you, but not if you've had it before that.
Well, that's right, Mike. Yes. So what you're doing with the antibody test is you're looking at the response that your body makes to the infection. So it takes a little while for that to build up. It can be picked up before 28 days, but if you want to be sure that you haven't had it, you need to wait for a while and test.
Right.
It's a very useful test to have, because it will help us understand whether people are at risk of getting infection when they're a contact to somebody else who's had the infection.
Yes. So, I mean, how soon are you hopeful that that might be available?
Well, there are a number of people developing these tests, as I say, and they are optimistic that we'll have tests either towards the end of May or early June, which is around the sort of time. I mean, I think everyone's been saying coronavirus is going to be with us for some time. Mm. So what we really want is a good test that's reliable and that people can work with. And it does look as if we're going to have that about the sort of time that we need it.
Yeah, and I mean, it's been quite remarkable the amount of capacity that you've been able to increase, but really by just in the past week alone.
Well, I think that's right, Mike. I mean, so many people have been involved here, and it's an opportunity to pay tribute to, you know, the NHS pathology laboratories, the new commercial labs that have been set up by volunteers, working with industry, working with our universities. The Army have helped us with the mobile units. Huge numbers of people working in government on the logistics, you know, securing the supply chains, and indeed the suppliers themselves, you know, the companies who make these tests. It's very much been a joint effort, and people have done really, really well. And the public have been incredibly supportive. So just back where we are, people who are in this group, the people over 65, I would encourage them to log on to gov.uk, get yourself booked in for a test. There are slots available today. If you need a test, we can offer you one.
OK, that's brilliant stuff. Thank you very much indeed. Professor John Newton, coordinator of the National Testing Programme, Director of Public Health Improvement for Public Health England. I think that pretty much sums up where we are. There is a great deal of capacity. Now, there are slots that you can book. If you are over 65 and you do have symptoms and you think that you should get one of those tests, by all means, go on the gov.co.uk site and get on it and get a test sorted out. Let's talk to Peter, who's in Berkshire. Hello, Peter.
Ah, good afternoon, Mike.
Good afternoon.
Great to talk to you.
Very nice to talk to you. What can I do for you?
Mike, I'm getting terribly frustrated with the distortion of statistics that we see, and particularly from the BBC.
Mm.
They've published something today about 100 care workers that had died.
Yes.
And I started questioning the figures, and I'll try and keep it simple, but my calculations are that of the 23,000 deaths thereabouts in the population of 65 million in the country represents about 0.035%.
Okay.
If you look at the number of deaths, say around about 100, it might be just over 100, on a working population of 450,000 doctors, nurses and midwives, it actually works out at 0.022%. In other words, almost half of the death rate in the population.
Yes.
Now, since I spoke to you, since I put the call in, I've actually found a learned report from a company called HSJ. And what they've done a lot more detailed analysis than I have. And they have found that of the patient facing NHS workers. They represent about 1% of the population of the country.
Right.
The deaths amongst those are 0.5%, which comes to the same figure as I arrived at.
Right.
About 0.5%. And one of the points in their report was that actually the number of those who are in serious facing, you know, anaesthetists and the people in intensive care, the figures were quite low indeed.
Mm.
And so I must emphasize, I am not having the NHS are doing a brilliant job. But the figures aren't nearly as much as the scaremongering seems to be suggesting. They are actually quite good. Mm. And of course, those figures don't take into account where they got the report says that they can't account for that every one of the NHS workers caught the virus.
No. While they were actually at work. No, I get that. Listen, Peter, it's a great call. I've got to cut it short, I'm afraid, because we're running late, but thank you for that call. Yeah, I think the trouble is, with all the statistics in this entire shebang, they're all coming from different places. Some things are included, other things aren't included. Other countries do it differently. You know, the comparison game is a dangerous one to play.
Talk Radio. Across the UK. Online. On DAB. And on your smart speaker. The Independent Republic of Mike Graham. On Talk Radio.
If you enjoyed that, be sure to catch the whole show 10 to 1, Monday to Friday on Talk Radio via DAB online or via the Talk Radio app. And if you have an opinion on the stories we cover, we'd love to hear from you. Call us on 0344 499 1000 or tweet at Talk Radio during the show to have your say.
Mid-morning with Mike Graham. Talk Radio.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win. And support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.